Hey, this is Mark Stein. Welcome to another edition of our Clubland Q&A live across the planet. It is 4 p.m. North American Eastern Times. That means it's 5 p.m. in the Canadian Maritimes. It's 5:30 in Newfoundland because we love half-hour time zones. So we want to hear from you if you live in a half-hour time zone. 6 o'clock in Bermuda, 9 o'clock British summer time in London, or bovine spongiform time, as one of our readers put it to us. 10 o'clock Western Europe, 11 o'clock in Cairo, midnight in Moscow, wherever you are. We would like to hear from you. If you're a Mark Stein Club member, just shoot me a query. And if you're not a Mark Stein Club member, you can sign up right now. And if you're a brand new member, we will make a point of looking out for your question and determining whether it meets our criteria. I was on with Tucker Carlson last night, and we were talking about Robert Reich, who was the former Labour Secretary under Bill Clinton, who says that impeaching Trump isn't enough. The entire Trump presidency has to be annulled. Now, he concedes that Trump is likely to emerge well from the midterm elections in November, and he actually says that Trump is likely to win re-election in 2020. So why does he want to annul the Trump presidency? Well, he says there's no evidence of this. There's no evidence of this, but if there should be evidence that Trump has been colluding with Putin to steal the election, then the whole thing has to be annulled. Meanwhile, John Brennan doubled down. He's the former CIA director, doubled down on the accusation of treason against Trump. And Bill Maher, I've got nothing against Bill Maher. Bill Maher actually is quite a principled lefty when it comes to free speech issues, and he's certainly tougher on Islam than most people on the left are, which is why he's had to face all these stupid university bans and all the rest of it. But he said something absolutely dotty to John Brennan. He said he thought this was the third great crisis in American history. There was the Revolutionary War, there was the Civil War, and now there's Trump. And like they're sitting around having a, you know, doing a television show afterwards. They open a bottle of wine. They have a glass of wine. What are you going to do about it? If it's up with the Revolutionary War, the Civil War, and now this, what do you, in the Revolutionary War, they pledged their lives, their fortunes, and their sacred honor. And I made a rather cheap crack because I'm into cheap cracks these days. I made a rather cheap crack last night on the telly because I believe Bill Maher was dating some Canadian singer-songwriter. Not me, as far as I know, but some other Canadian singer-songwriter. And I said, if this is like the new Revolutionary War, that's a bit like George Washington dating a United Empire loyalist. This is decadence. These people aren't serious. It's ridiculous. If it's the Revolutionary War, if it's the Civil War, it's not something just to chit-chat around over, oh, yes, Trump's guilty of treason. Oh, I say, how frightfully amusing. What's interesting to me about this is that phrase they used all, they use it every time, but it took on a life of its own between last November 2016, and January 20th, 2017, when President Trump was sworn in. They keep going on about the peaceful transfer of power. All the commentators, oh, America. America's the only country that has a peaceful transfer of power. Because I speak as a Canadian here, because in Canada, of course, we don't have a peaceful transfer of power. You know, when you have an election in Canada and another guy wins, they throw the old prime minister off the roof of 24 Sussex Drive, and then they ritually disembowel him and hang him from a lamppost. If you're wondering why we haven't heard anything from Stephen Harper in the last couple of years, that's because when Justin took over, that's what he did to Stephen Harper. We're not quite like Liberia. In Liberia, the fella, I can't remember his name now, he seized power from Master Sergeant Sam Doe, who was that week's president for life. And in a scene out of Quentin Tarantino's Reservoir Dogs, they chopped off the ears. Two of the guards chopped off Sam Doe's ears and ate them. And then the new guy ordered him to chop off Sam Doe's wedding tackle, and the new guy at that, on the basis that that is how the powers of the old leader are transferred to the new leader. That's also how they do things in Australia, I believe. Malcolm Turnbull, I believe the new guy had his genitals chopped off, and they ate them in the first cabinet meeting of the new government. So America, as we know from all this, is the only country that has the peaceful transfer of power. But the way they went on about it between November and January 20th, methinks the lady doth protest too much. The more they kept going on about the peaceful transfer of power, the more they made it sound as if something strange and conditional existed about this so-called peaceful transfer of power. And you begin to understand why, because in that period between November and the end of January, all these forces, including this reptilian, ghastly, awful person, John Brennan, were actually working to hollow out the peaceful transfer of power and subvert the incoming government, which is quite a big deal. And as I said, it's like the, you know, Shakespeare and protesting too much. The fact that they kept going on about the peaceful transfer of power was, in fact, a fairly obvious clue that behind the scenes they were beavering away to subvert it. So we'll take your questions on that. And as I said, in Australia they have the Liberian system where they eat the outgoing Prime Minister's genitals. So we'll discuss that. Any Australian club members who are in the new cabinet and chowed down on Malcolm Turnbull's private parts will be interested to hear what you have to say. And I do also want to interested to know from any of our UK members about something which is really quite extraordinary. There was an idiotic piece in the New York Times today by some fella who's an editor. I think he's the New York correspondent of the Sunday Times of London. And it's in reference to the Jew hate in Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party. And this idiot in the New York Times says, oh, this all goes back to the old school English anti-Semitism that you see from Virginia Woolf and Agatha Christie. So this is a guy, for a start, this tells you, this is a guy who's read about anti-Semitism in a book. If the only people you know who are anti-Semites are writers, that's a sign you don't get out of the house often enough. You know, for a start, that isn't true. Virginia Woolf actually married a Jew. Agatha Christie, this stupid even to have to discuss this. Agatha Christie, the very first book, whatever it's, what's it called? The Mysterious Affair at Stiles? There's a Jewish character in that. And yes, some of her characters don't like the Jew, not just because he's Jewish, but because the chick in the book is hot for the Jew. That's in Agatha Christie's first novel. But I don't even want to get into all that. That's like the lightly worn condescension toward the exotic other that all kinds of societies have to one degree or another. And there's a difference between, say, not thinking a Jew is quite pucker and not wanting him to be a member of your club, and to take a random example, slitting a Jew's throat in the stairwell of his apartment house and gouging his eyes out and ripping his face off and then standing there in the stairwell, dripping in blood and crowing, "I have killed my Jew," which is what some guy was crowing after he killed a Parisian disc jockey a couple of years ago in what's becoming a kind of fairly routine form of ritual slaughter for French Jews. There's a difference. I mean, we would love it, actually. In Toulouse, the Jews would love it if the people who are making it dangerous for them to go out on the street were instead just to say, "I really don't want this chap being a member of my country club." There's a difference between slitting throats, gouging a guy's eyes out, ripping your face off, and the two are not connected here. And what's happening in Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party, they're having their conference and Jewish delegates to the Socialist Workers' Party celebrate diversity, the workers' utopia, Jewish delegates have to have bodyguards in Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party. And there's nothing difficult about this. It's not because they're all closet Virginia Woolf fans or they've been reading too many Hercule Poirot or Miss Marple mysteries. It's because 85% of British Muslims vote for Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party, and it is a fact, and I'd put it no higher than that, but not attaching any moral weight to it, but it is a fact that large numbers of Muslims are totally antipathetic to Jews. And so if you depend, it's simple democratic arithmetic, that there is nothing for Jeremy Corbyn to be gained in telling Muslims to cut out the Jew hate. That's democracy once you are in a diverse society. I mean, and actually, I might as well cut to the chase here. Democracy works, but one of the necessary conditions for democracy is generally an homogenous population that's all agreed on the basic rules of society, and then you can have a nice little civilized vote every 3, 4, 5 years on whether you want a party that favours low tax and high welfare, or a party that favours low tax and low welfare, or high tax and high welfare. And if you don't have that, if you get over-diverse, then you wind up with tribal politics, which are the antithesis of real democracy. But because essentially the more diverse you get, the more tribal voting becomes. And in Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party, one of the tribes that makes up his coalition are British Muslims. 85% of them vote for him. And that is in crude reasons. That's the crude reason why the more Muslim his party gets, the less friendly it is to Jews. You can bemoan that, but there's no point pretending it's anything to do, like this idiot in the New York Times today, anything to do with Virginia Woolf and Agatha Christie. Okay, on to your questions. Marie writes, I work during your show today, so I can't submit this question online during it, but I would like your thoughts on the father of Molly Tibbetts stating that the Hispanic community were just like Iowans, but with better food. While one must give the benefit of the doubt to a grieving father, as I was born a fifth-generation Iowan who enjoyed wonderful homemade food at her grandmother's table, one can't but feel attacked. I thought we were beyond judging one culture's culinary delights to be better than another's. Marie, the first thing that should be said, I agree with what you said. Molly Tibbetts was this 20-year-old woman who was murdered by an illegal immigrant in Iowa, and her body was dumped in a cornfield, and that is and the accused murderer was eventually arrested by police and led the authorities to the body. And since then, they've been playing down some of the various problematic aspects of this. But I agree with Marie that no one would want to find themselves in the situation that the Tibbetts family is in, where your beloved daughter has been murdered. None of us know how we would react to that. But there is, I think, a general strain of what one might call self-loathing that is now deeply ingrained within our society. And Molly Tibbetts, who seems to have been a pleasant, likable, attractive, functioning college student, was not untypical about that. On December 12th last year, she actually issued a tweet saying, "I hate white people," which is weird because she's white. She's from Iowa, white bread Iowa, white bread family. But somehow, by the time she'd reached the age of 20, the civilizational self-loathing, even in Iowa, that she'd imbibed, presumably from kindergarten and grade school and middle school and high school, is such that she thinks it's quite normal just to tweet, I hate white people. Now then we come to her father. And her father has had his daughter murdered, and there are political implications to the murder. There are public policy implications to the murder. This country consciously chooses to admit millions of people to live here illegally. Meanwhile, I came back. I've been in Banff, Alberta, and I got back late last night. I landed at Montreal and was sort of crossing the border at about 2 a.m. And there was some bored twerp at the border post, nothing better to do. So he was asking me like 40 stupid questions, including what I was going to do by the time I got home. And I said I was going to go to sleep. And, you know, it's like just complete time wasting. And even more stupid and insulting in a country that's admitted basically the population of Canada illegally to live in the United States. I mean, that's how stupid this whole thing is. So there are public policy implications to the murder of Molly Tibbetts. And this father's way of dealing with them is to say, oh, Hispanics are just like Iowans with better food. Yeah, I don't know. I don't begrudge the guy that. A big shot German had his daughter murdered by one of the so-called refugees last year. And his suggestion was to mark the death of his daughter by giving money to assist in the resettlement of refugees. It's a terrible, dark thing. I don't know. I can't even begin to imagine how I would react to, God help us, the situation that the Tibbetts family are in or this German family from last year are in. But it is not an uncommon thing for the thing to turn in on itself and even in the midst of your grief, to feel that virtue signaling about the demographic conditions that killed your daughter are somehow the appropriate reaction. In the end, we will have to be more serious about how we treat these things. I think those tweets by Molly Tibbetts are sad and tragic. They're tragic. To raise 20, a generation in America that thinks it's cool to tweet, I hate white people, is quite astonishing to me. And you can say, well, it's ironic and everything that the poor girl got murdered and all the rest of it. It isn't really ironic. It's actually, the people who raise a generation of Americans to hate themselves are guilty of a form of child abuse, and it is a terrible thing. Chris Hall writes, Mark, I'm interested in your take on the whole NAFTA negotiation scenario that's currently playing out. Although most Americans focus on the U.S.-Mexico aspect of things, here in Michigan, we know that the big bucks involve the U.S.-Canada relationship. People here are getting a bit nervous, given that a lot of the auto industry has been shaped by first the FTA and then NAFTA. As usual, Canadian nationalism has reared up in their political discussions. I'm from Canada, so I know it's nothing new, says Chris. But usually the adults in the room cool things down and work out the problem. Do you really think that the libs in Ottawa think that when Robert Reich whips open the shower curtain, he'll see Hillary? That's what I was talking about with Tucker Lasser. Look, this whole NAFTA thing now, Trump basically, the US and the Mexicans have reached an agreement. And Canada's foreign minister, unbelievably enough, Chrystia Freeland, who's basically from my line of work, when I was at the National Post in Canada, she was a deputy assistant deputy editor at the Globe and Mail. She's flying into Washington today to negotiate on NAFTA with the U.S. administration. But basically, the Mexicans and the Americans have got together and done a deal, and Justin Trudeau is going to be invited to the signing ceremony. I actually said this when I was on AM 640 on the John Oakley show last week. They don't mind Justin's like a nice, when he dresses up as a Bollywood bridesmaid, he looks awfully cute, so it's nice to have him at the signing ceremony. But basically the world, the other two parties to this have moved on without them. And I think actually, that's the fascinating thing. Trump is mocked as an idiot on a lot of this stuff. But if you want to roll up the whole trade deal thing, where do you start? You don't start with China. You don't start with the European Union. That stuff is all messy and difficult. And the way to roll these things up and get to where you want, which is a deal with China. For example, one of the components of since you mentioned the automobile industry, Chris, one of the interesting components about this new US-Mexico deal is the agreement they've reached on cars that are genuinely made in North America, which means either Canada, the US, or Mexico. Because until now, until this deal, China has been making a lot of car parts. The car parts are then shipped to Mexico, and the car parts are put in the car in Mexico and then shipped north. And so in a sense, China has been using NAFTA as a kind of backdoor into the US economy for its auto parts. And they've now put a stop to that. And I think that shows you what the end game is here, is that Trump has plotted out a sort of roadmap that gets him to what he really wants, which is the biggest free trade abuser on the planet, and that's China, which will be the last piece of this puzzle. Alman from CA, as in California, I believe, writes, back in the day when Robert Reich was still in government, I remember watching one of the Sunday Talking Heads shows. Reich was asked his opinion about deficits and national debt, and he approved of them. Shocking. Okay, Mark, here is the question. Whose opinion has more value and relevance, the Reich opinion on Trump and our form of elective government, or Bill Clinton's opinion on Stormy and her profession? I don't know what Bill Clinton's opinion on Stormy Daniels is. But I don't think we should let Robert Reich off the hook here. It's not a small... Do you know, I made a point to Tucker last night, which was just kind of... Because I was like joking around about it being like the famous episode of Dallas where Victoria Principal gets into the shower and Bobby Ewing has come back to life. And it's the same thing here. Robert Reich has got into the shower and Hillary Clinton... is amazingly back alive, and she's the president. And it's like a throwaway gag, but in consequence, I sort of skated over the big point, which is that when a former cabinet secretary denies the legitimacy of the successor government, when Robert Reich basically calls for the annulment of the Trump presidency, he's not getting at Trump. He's not attacking Trump. He's actually... attacking the very possibility of functioning self-government by a free people. Because he's saying that it's also hyper-partisan, that if the wrong guy wins, it doesn't just mean you had a bad night. It's actually not a legitimate result. And so that's what he's attacking. Ken Costa writes from my hometown of Toronto. Good afternoon, Mark, he says. As a fellow Canadian, I'm becoming increasingly frustrated by our local media's bizarre obsession with all things American. Whenever I turn on the CBC, CTV, Global, or even my local news station, all I hear is Trump this and America that. Same thing if I pick up a copy of the Globe and Mail, the National Post, or the Toronto Star. More attention was given to the latest Florida shooting than to the latest shooting in New Brunswick. More coverage was devoted to the passing of Senator John McCain than to the removal of a statue of Sir John A. Macdonald. It has come to the point where I have to rely on foreign news sources to find out what is happening in Canada. Fox News broke the story of the Danforth atrocity. This was the vehicular homicide thing in Toronto a couple of weeks ago. Fox News broke the story of the Danforth atrocity before the Toronto stations did. I'm not naive enough to think that the policies of the world's only superpower and our largest trading partner have no effect on the lives of Canadians like me. But the attention devoted to those policies is coming at the expense of any form of serious questioning of the policies and practices of our own government. What you say is true, Ken, and actually it's a uniquely Canadian thing. For example, I mentioned Australia at the top of the show. The Australian media are engaged with the world. They have their biases. They cover American news. They cover news from the United Kingdom. They cover news from China. But if you switch on your typical Australian news bulletin, you'll get a lot of news from hither and yon, all over the place, including news from home. And that's true if you're in, if you're watching the German news, they'll have news from Russia and news from Italy and news from America and news from Britain and what have you. So this obsession, this weird thing, which is certainly a phenomenon of Canadian news, where you have this bizarre focus on one particular country, and it's not actually the country you're living in, is kind of weird. And I think it fulfills two functions. First, it enables the Canadian media to be condescending about America, but also to go to the point you're making, it comes at the expense of any form of serious questioning of the policies and practices of our own government. That's how you put it. And that isn't accidental. Because, for example, it's easy to cover a Florida shooting if you're not American. So, you know, there's some school in a foreign country where some people have been killed. And you can cover, these American, crazy Americans with their guns, blah, 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 blah. If you have a situation like that appalling business with the hockey team and the bus crash and everything, the political implications for that are a lot closer to home, and nobody in the Canadian media wants to examine them. Or the Danforth shooting, where basically the media are colluding with the authorities, basically the police department, in actually keeping basic core information from the Canadian public. So it's always much easier. There's a school shooting in America. This shows Americans need to get rid of guns. An illegal immigrant was arrested taking his wife to the maternity ward. This shows they need it. Whereas if you have to do that about your own people, your own society, you would need a lot more courage, frankly, and you would need a lot more genuine curiosity than the Canadian media demonstrates. I'd love to see a serious discussion, for example, on Maxime Bernier's attitude to diversity. But they really don't want to go there. So the easy option is just to say, what cookie things have the Americans done today? And we'll just cover that. Matthew McWilliams writes about my segment with Tucker about annulling reality, which is basically what Robert Reich is calling for. I'd like your thoughts on where the country goes after the elections in November. It seems to me there are two choices. The Democrats succeed in taking at least the House, in which case we get never-ending investigations of the Trump administration, or B, the Republicans manage to hold both the House and the Senate, in which case we get to see if the volume goes past 11 on the vitriol meter. If it is B, do we get the violence Tucker referenced? Is there a good outcome here? Well, you put it very carefully, Matthew. If the Democrats succeed in taking the House, you say we'll get never-ending investigations of the Trump administration. And I think you've put it brilliantly. I don't think they actually want, and certainly the leadership doesn't want, by which I mean Nancy Pelosi and Chuck Schumer, they don't want impeachment, because once they do that, you're basically inviting civil war. But what they would like is never-ending investigations that make it impossible for the Trump presidency to function. So that's what would happen if Democrats win the House. If the Republicans hold the House and Senate, I think the Reich craziness will get worse and worse. And you're just going to see this alternate reality, these guys say, want to live in. I think they actually will actually start living in it. They won't recognize anything. They will basically be creating a sort of progressive virtual reality in which Trump is guilty of treason and stole the election with Putin and did it so effectively that he was also able to steal the midterms. Jamie Marsh writes, Mark, U.S. Representative Mark Meadows said today that the DOJ FBI planted stories in the press, which in turn were then used to support Pfizer warrants or FISA warrants. I don't know how you pronounce it. In fact, I don't care, because I'm not even sure that court should exist and these stupid warrants should exist. If true, as I expect it is, it's not really that surprising, is it? No. Bruce Orr, this guy, he was the deputy assistant under Attorney General in the Department of Justice. He was his whole thing, his area is supposed to be drugs and gangs. But somehow he became the point man, the liaison between funneling Christopher Steele's dirty dossier into the mainstream of FBI, DOJ, getting it into the making it central to this so-called Russia investigation thing. That's an obvious racket. It's not his department. Now, I don't even think you need a stupid deputy assistant under associate, whatever the hell he is, attorney general. But if he is, and if his area of expertise, his area of responsibility is drugs and gangs, what the hell is he doing running the getting his hands into the Russia investigation, using this lousy dossier with a foreign spy and a company his wife works for? I mean, how many? He's been demoted 3 times, this guy, because he used to be assistant deputy associate. He used to be, I think, associate deputy attorney general. And then he was demoted to assistant associate deputy attorney general. And then he was demoted from that to under assistant deputy attorney general. He's got a long way to go. He could be down, you know, before he hits janitor or whatever the lowest position there. Actually, janitor is probably still, because there's probably an associate deputy janitor and an assistant deputy associate janitor and an under assistant. So there's probably a lot to go, even if he gets down to janitor. But the fact here is that this obviously doesn't smell right. He's the drugs guy. Why is he messing around with a foreign spy who's got a dirty dossier paid for by his wife's boss? Why are we even holding inquiries about this? If this came up at a county court, if you were in the rinky-dinkiest little county court in Nowheresville, if you were in the family division, if you were in for your divorce, and your estranged wife's judge had some, the judge's wife worked for your spouse's lawyer, he'd recuse himself. But apparently you can't do that at the Department of Justice itself without, you know, having years and years of inquiries and investigations about it. Bradford Stephen Carl writes, the classic interaction was when Reich was promoting a minimum wage and Leonard Peikoff asked him, why not $100 minimum wage, an hour minimum wage? Reich said, I suppose so that you could be director of that department. That's a lot of truth there. Andy writes, hi, Mark. A couple of months ago, you spoke of the Windsor, Ontario waxing salon that denied a transgender person, a Brazilian, because the waxologist was Muslim. Now, that's true. I think I mentioned this on Rush, and I said in a couple of years' time, these will be the only news stories around. This was a transgender who still has the old meat and two veg down there and went to a waxing salon where the waxologist is Muslim. So the Muslima has to wax the transgender's meat and two veg, twig and berries. And and obviously if a Muslima does that, then her husband it would be outraged and would have to kill her. So it's a very problematic. There's no correct answer to that. If you're a guy who owns a waxing salon and you've got a transgender coming in complaining about a Muslima waxologist, you're screwed. There's no correct answer. It doesn't matter how much virtue signaling you do, you're screwed. Now, says Andy, a transgender person has filed human rights complaints against 15 different waxing parlours across British Columbia after she went fishing for salons that would deny her an appointment. This is another transgender person who's got male genitalia. That's the fact. That's the interesting. I wrote about this in Monday's thing. Once upon a time, people used to have sex changes, so they got rid of the male genitalia. Now, an awful lot of people who identify as women still have male genitalia, and it's become a thing. Women with penises. And as I was writing about in Monday's notebook, there's a feminist group that is objecting to the idea that a woman can have a penis. Because you used to have all this thing, feminists complained about the phallocracy, everything being phallocentric. Now women are literally phallocentric. They've got penises. You can't get more phallocentric than having a penis, which women have now. So this woman with a penis, this transgender lady in British Columbia, she's filed a reverse class action suit, in effect, against 15 different waxing salons who don't want to give her a Brazilian. So basically, this is the most unwaxed set of genitalia in the province of British Columbia. There's nothing like it. It's like the great northern forests of British Columbia have nothing on this woman's genitalia because she can't get anyone to wax her. So she keeps taking her male genitalia to every waxing salon, and they say, well, actually, we don't know what we're getting into when we do that, and the Muslim waxologists don't want to do that. And so she's now basically filed this. She sued 15 different waxing parlours. Right? She's filed suit. Now, that's... I don't know. At least she's suing 15 different people. This scofflaw, deadbeat, criminal bum in Las Vegas, Carrie Katz, he's just filed 15 different suits against me. And you know you're listening. What's the name of that? Eric M. George. He's the sleazy lawyer. They listen to this show all the time because they find out what I'm going to say about them. But this, like, his sleazy bum client has filed a gazillion different suits against me. Say what you like about this transgender person with the world's most hirsute genitals. At least she's suing different people. These are the only stories you're ever going to have in the future. There will be no other kinds of news stories. It'll just be transgender activist suing Muslima waxologist. That's all it is. Terry Sauter writes, in a May 22nd, 2018 post, you wrote about Stefan Halper and quoted Sarah Carter. Yesterday, Sarah Carter reported on Department of Defense whistleblower Adam Lovinger. Is easy because you're beautiful. Love that song. Adam Lovinger, who became curious when he found $1 million in payments to Stefan Halper for nothing much. Lovinger's attorney says that Adam unwittingly shined a spotlight on the deep state secret weapon, Stefan Halper, and the Trump-Russia narrative was all a setup. Yes, of course it was. Basically, the whole Russia thing was a reverse engineering thing to find a narrative to explain why a bunch of people with high-level intelligence connections, like Stefan Halper. If you look at my May 2018 piece, Stefan Halper is a guy who has had CIA and MI6 connections going back almost half a century. And he's now a sort of emeritus professor at Cambridge, which means he doesn't actually teach anything. He just has a rather sort of convenient perch at Cambridge, so that when he wants to set up some guy who's working for the Trump campaign, he organises a conference about nothing in particular and invites the guy there to entrap him. What the whole Trump-Russia narrative thing is not about Russian, it's not about foreign interference in the American election, which is one thing. And I don't disagree with that. I'm a foreigner and I interfere in America's elections all the time. And I am free to do that, actually. America interferes in foreign elections. Countries are entitled to pursue their national interests insofar as they want to do it. And if they do something illegal, you get the goods on them and you do something about it. But in this case, the story wasn't foreign interference with America's election. It was domestic interference with America's election by agents of America's intelligence community, like this Stephen Halper guy, who got a seven-figure sum of money for not doing anything terribly much, according to this whistleblower, Adam Lovinger. And I think it's clear now that that is the actual story here. There was conscious domestic interference in the 2016 election at the highest level. Something went wrong and the wrong guy won. So all these guys wake up on Wednesday morning, November the 9th or whatever it was, and they say, holy cow, we have got to figure out a way to retrospectively clean up the trail we've left. And the way they cleaned up the trail was to impose this Russian narrative, this Russian story on what was happening. The Russian story has only one purpose, and it was to the foreign interference with the 2016 election is there to provide cover for serial domestic interference, which of course is far more serious. Toby Pilling writes, William Hague, the ex-leader of the Conservative Party in the UK, recently warned his colleagues that his party was at risk of monomaniac entryists. As an ex-member of UKIP myself, who joined his party in order to have a say on Brexit and a future leader, is he right to fear me and my ilk? He certainly fears your ilk, Toby. He doesn't want your ilk anywhere near his party. The Conservative Party in Britain, has its membership has fallen in part because there's a gap between what the membership wants and what the people who run the party wants. You're seeing this with the betrayal of Brexit. So the question is whether this is the same guy, by the way, William Hague, who a few years ago, they were all into populism. They were all into encouraging the grassroots to have a say, to join the party, to make your voice heard. Well, the voice they want to be heard is the voice that says, hello, we voted to leave the European Union. Is that happening anytime soon? And Mrs. May's betrayal of that, essentially, Theresa May led a cabal of civil servants and other sort of permanent members of the elite construct a narrative whereby it would become impossible to leave the European Union. It's like welcome to the Hotel Brexifornia. You can check out any time you like on your referendum box, but you can never leave. And that was the lesson, in meaningful lesson of her Chequers agreement and all the other nonsense, is that it doesn't matter what, it doesn't matter how you vote, doesn't matter the referendum, it's not going to happen, it can't happen, it's impossible to happen, and it's rubbish. This idea that the Jeremy Paxman, who in his dotage has become a deeply unimpressive figure from the way he was at his peak. But he said, how many trade agreements has the British government actually negotiated since 1973? And he's talking to a country that has written more constitutions for more sovereign nations than anybody in human history. And somehow now it's all impossible and can't be done. This whole rubbish about the Irish border. The Irish border was created in 1922. No continentals were involved. Nobody from Brussels were involved. One part of Ireland and another part of Ireland decided they didn't want to be in the same unified nation state anymore. And so a de facto border arose that had minimal real world meaning. It was an international frontier in a technical sense, but it was the most minimalist one. Dublin and London administered that border. It had nothing to do with Brussels. So the idea now that a great sovereign nation, they want us to have a border post. How are we going to do that? What Theresa May and William Hague and all the rest of them are doing is to invite total contempt for what remains of the British Conservative Party. A deserved contempt. A deserved contempt. Emily Maximov writes. Oh, actually, I've had a lot of beard. We got a lot of beard queries today. Beard queries. I say that, you know, I'm talking about my facial hair. Not when I'm seen around town with a woman who's designed to, you know, throw attention away from the fact that I'm an obvious homosexual or whatever. I'm using beard in the sense of facial hair. Scott Scherzer writes, how much longer do you expect the deep state can get away with the Russia collusion travesty? And more importantly, what's up with your facial hair? That's from Miami Beach, where they appreciate facial hair. A lot of guys with very trim beards around Miami Beach, I notice. Emily Maximov writes, hi, Mark, are you going to write an obituary for your beard? I might as well. We're going to spend the rest of the show talking about my beard. What happened was I was away for most of the summer. And when I'm away, one of the things I generally do is I shave off my beard just in case I happen to run. You know, I'm trekking through Uzbekistan and I happen to run into a fan of my guest hosting of Tucker Carlson Tonight. So to throw them off the track, so I don't, that doesn't, because it's embarrassing when you're, in Kazakhstan or whatever, and somebody says, hey, you, it's my, so I shave off my beard so I can pass among the natives. Well, not actually in Uzbekistan, because they're mostly bearded, but you take the point. I shave off the beard. And I forgot I was coming back, so I didn't start regrowing my beard until, like, you're getting the full scoop here now, until, like, 48 hours before I was due to guest host. I was due to appear on Fox News in New York. So I forget to grow the beard back. So I'm all bleached by being out in the sun, so my hair's a slightly lighter colour than usual as well. And and I'm in New York. And the makeup, and it's like a big crisis. I'm about to go on with Brian Kilmeade on a Monday night on Fox. And I'm there in the makeup room, and I've just got this like a couple of days of wispy, blondie, strawberry blondie growth on my face. And all these hair and makeup, the entire Fox hair and makeup department are all clustered around me. So this is a crisis. What are we going to do? Do you think we should... should we get rid of the beard entirely? Should we darken the beard so that it looks fuller? Should we do this? Should we do that? And eventually I was like paralyzed by fear. You know, I can't remember what I was talking about. North Korea, Iran, who cares? The important thing, nobody even notices what you say about North Korea or Iran if you look like a total mess on TV. So we were paralyzed with fear. I didn't want to do the thing Geraldo did. Hope I'm not giving anything away here. But Geraldo, he had this, last year sometime, he put like the old Just for Men. You know that stuff? You buy it in the pharmacy. Put the old Just for Men on the beard. And then the phone rang. So he's like taking a phone call. And he leaves the Just for Men on his face, which you only meant to leave on for 3 minutes, and then you wash it off, and it's sort of a subtle colour. And so instead he left it on for like 40 minutes while he took this phone call, and it was like this helmet of black gloss on his... and so... mindful of the Geraldo experience, I didn't want to try experimenting with anything 10 minutes before we went on air. So I just left it as this sort of... And then it became a thing, and people said, "Oh, I thought you looked quite nice without the full beard and all of it." So now I'm like, I don't know what to do. It's like it feels a bit like 1980s designer stubble thing to me. You know, the bit like the way George Michael and the guys used to do it. And I don't know, and I don't really know what to do about it. So I mean, it's sad. Emily, thank you for mourning my beard. I might write an obituary for my beard. I miss, I do miss my beard. I'm not going to tell you who I gave it to, but she's suing some British Columbia wax clinics right now. Anyway. Thank you very much for that call. Bradford Stephen Clyle writes, "Am I simply ignorant, or is the popular use of the term virtue signalling a recent occurrence? I never heard it until quite recently." You're right. Actually, I should know the name of this, but someone specific did invent it, and it caught on. And I think it actually is an important phrase because it says what the left does. And someone should actually have invented it 50 years ago, because if you look at, going back to LBJ and the Great Society in America, which destroyed the black family, but it made whites feel good. And if you look at the practical consequences of most liberal policies, it's about making the people who promote them feel good about themselves. So, for example, in Europe, when they let in all the excitable young Mohammedan men, it's sad that people are getting gang raped and what have you when they walk home from the station every night. But in the end, you don't really care because it makes you feel good about yourself. So a little bit of gang rape here and a little bit of gang rape there and young girls being dragged off into the bushes and sexually assaulted. You can live with that. Because the policy signals your virtue. So it's a tremendous phrase because it gets to the heart. I mean, if you take black people in particular in the United States, wholly owned subsidiary of the Democrat Party, and they have nothing to show for it. Nothing to show for it. Because they're not the reason the policy exists. The policy exists to make upper middle class white people feel good about themselves while they're listening to NPR, National Public Radio. That's the whole point of it. Michelle Dulac writes, "I get sort of Reich going ape over Trump, though honestly I haven't seen anyone melt down so thoroughly since Paul Krugman. But what incarnation has he against Mike Pence? All he can see about Mike Pence is that he professes to think what everyone professed to think about gay marriage 10 years ago, and that he doesn't care to eat alone with a woman, not his wife. As the wife of a public school teacher, I'm with him there. The restrictions on what you can do, e.g. never shut your door under any circumstances if there's a student in your office. Trump is Hitler, so Pence is obviously another Hitler, just as Romney and McCain and Reagan were. Everyone's Hitler. Mike Pence is why you can't have impeachment. And if they were to win the House in November, this is actually how they would think, Michelle, because nobody has been. The idea of, say, you know, obviously Bill Clinton wasn't removed from office. Nixon wasn't removed from office. He resigned. So that there is a question about whether you can actually remove a president from office or whether in the end that's just not going to happen. But if you think about it like that, the circumstances that would drive a legislature to remove a president from office are more likely to apply for a character like Trump than they are for John Kasich or George W. Bush or whoever you want to name. You know, in other words, everything about Trump is extraordinary. So that, in a sense, doing something extraordinary to someone who's already extraordinary it requires less of an imaginative leap than, say, doing it to Mitt Romney or Bob Dole or John McCain or whoever. So if any president was actually going to be yanked out of office against his will, it would likely be a character like Donald Trump. And this is how I'm looking at how these guys will be calculating it if they win the House in November. What's going to stop them? Mike Pence, who would be by far the most conservative and certainly the most socially conservative president that America has seen in a long time. And as you pointed out, he doesn't like to be in the company of women, not his wife. So I think, what was it Greg Gutfeld said? He's so conservative, he won't even be alone with his wife. that's the fact that as the fever swamps of impeachment were to become a reality if the Democrats won the House, President Mike Pence, the reality of that, and President Mike Pence, if they win the House in November, impeach Trump, he's gone, whoop, and Mike Pence has a year and a half to be the incumbent and run for office. They're not going to do that. Chris Dre writes, "Hi, Mark, I'm not really sure how this Q&A works." Well, that's disgraceful of you. We've got very hard rules on this, and we're going to fax you the rules right now so that you do know how it works next time. I'm outraged. Chris says, "Hi, Mark, I'm not really sure how this Q&A works, but here goes. I have a child living about 30 minutes from London. After watching the third world transformation of California and seeing your discussion with Douglas Murray, I have to confess concern for my children and grandchildren. Do you have any feel for how the next two decades in the UK will play out?" Yes, I think, I wrote a book about this. And I said at the top that I agree with Maxime Bernier that diversity is morally neutral. You can have five nice national public radio listening women of a certain age who, and it's not in the least bit diverse. You can then take five NPR listening women of a certain age and add Sudan's leading clitoridectomy practitioner. And it's more diverse, but it's not the better for it. And I think we have to get to where Maxime Bernier is in Canada and actually say, no, diversity in and of itself is a morally neutral value, and there's no point fetishizing it. And actually, ancient nation states should be able to determine their immigration policies on what's in the interests of the people who are already there. Now, they've left it awfully late for that in the United Kingdom. London is lost. London is a city where in the majority of London boroughs now, white British-born people, that's to say ethnic English, Scottish, Irish, Welsh, are a minority. That city is lost. And the question is how much of the rest of the country is going to be lost in that sense. And when you put it like that, people, oh, that's a racist thing to say. It's, you can apply all the labels, but in the end, what you have to answer is this. For example, the Jew hate in Jeremy Corbyn's Labour Party. These are people who are, you can say, oh, I don't care about Jews. Okay, well, what about the gay bars closing in the East End of London? Well, I don't care about gays either. Okay, what about women having to go covered in certain parts of town, at certain parts of night, because it's no longer safe to walk around? Okay. Eventually, the changes, it's not, so, again, it gets to the difference between virtue signaling and the practical realities of the world you have made. And this whole idea, I mean, everyone talks about immigration as if it has a consistent, coherent impact, no matter who immigrates or when. So people say, well, they said things about the Irish in the mid-19th century in America. Okay, well, it's not the mid-19th century, and these aren't Irish. And as I said, my bottom line is this, that 30% of all jobs are going to be gone by automation in the next 15 years. 30%. So any country, even if it closes the borders today, is going to have millions of unemployed people for whom it will be incredibly difficult to find lives of dignity and value. And when you talk about your children and grandchildren, to complicate that by having essentially people who have entirely incompatible views of how modern societies function will not work out well for them. Thank you for that. Question, Chris. There are going to be some very Sweden, for example, where Swedes will be an ethnic minority in their own country. They chose that. They virtue signaled themselves out of business, and that's astonishing. Anthony Vickery writes, Mark Stein columns occasionally contain startling asides along the lines of, quote, as the Duke of Windsor told me when we were scuba diving, or once stuck in a lift with Hervé Villechaize. You got that wrong, Anthony. As I actually wrote, as Hervé Villechaize told me when we were scuba diving. Hervé was good at it. Or once stuck in a lift with the Duke of Windsor. What is the most improbable or most memorable encounter you've had with someone famous or otherwise over your various careers? I don't like the implication I'm one of these name-dropping types, Anthony. That really isn't my bag at all. My late friend Larry Adler, the great harmonica player. Oh, did I just drop a name there? He was a great name-dropper. He was going to call his autobiography Name Drops Keep Falling on My Head. And on that note, I'm off. I'm off to get get a Muslim wax with Arnold Schwarzenegger. And we will see you on the next time we do our Clubland Q&A. Don't forget, the way to participate in this is all you have to do is join the Mark Stein Club, and you can ask me whatever question you want to ask when we do these things. You can come on our cruise. We're sailing next month. So, Anthony, if you dispute this idea that I've been in the scuba diving with the Duke of Windsor and in an elevator with Hervé Villechaize, come on the cruise. You can be in the piano bar with me and Hervé and the Duke of Windsor as we're doing I Will Survive at 3 a.m. before the bar closes. The Mark Stein Club cruise, it sails next month. From Montreal to Boston, it's going to be a grand old time. Michelle Backman will be there. John O'Sullivan. John's one of those guys, right? If you think John's met everybody. It's like if you stand on a street with John O'Sullivan, just like there's random people walking by, and hello, Winston, I haven't seen you in years. Hi, Bono, how's the old debt relief for Africa? John knows everybody. Want some serious name robbing? You come on the cruise. Mark Stein Cruise, sailing from Montreal to Boston next month. We will be sailing out on another Clubland Q&A very shortly, but the old clock on the wall, as they used to say at the BBC, the old clock on the wall, as Terry Wogan used to say, has now ticked past 5 p.m. North American Eastern Time. That's 10 p.m. British Summer Time. Have a terrific Wednesday morning, wherever you are in Asia, Australia, and the Pacific. And we will see you next time.